For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Coming up on today's show, we've got some health and fitness books in the RNIB library to get you kick-started for a new, healthier 2023. We've got the books of your life from Booker shortlisted author Claire Keegan. And from the archive, we'll hear about Candia McWilliams' book, What to Look For in Winter, a memoir in blindness. All that and more on today's Read On. But first, on today's show, let's head over to our friends at TechDoc. They've been finding out about some changes to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Now, I'm sure you are aware that RNIB's library has a huge collection of Braille and audio content that is completely free to borrow for people who are blind or partially sighted living in the UK. As well as digital download, the content is also available through your smart speaker and available through the post on physical media, such as CD. Now, the library has recently announced some changes to the CD delivery system, and here to help us understand what that means for you is RNIB's Digital Transformation Manager. Welcome back to RNIB Connect Radio, Paul Porter. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, it's great to be back again. It's been a little while, but I always enjoy coming on the show.
Thank you so much. So just tell us a little bit, Paul. It's intriguing, isn't it, that some folk actually are not across all this downloading. Some people still want to receive physical media, USB sticks and even CDs in the post.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, what I would say to listeners is that, you know, give a digital download a try, give a smart speaker skill a try, because at the end of the day you can choose what you want to read, when you want to read it. If you download a book and you don't like it, you can just delete it and try something else. But we still have a lot of people accessing our books through the traditional postal method, where you give RNIB a list of books and CDs are sent to you, and once you're finished listening to the CD you send it back, and the next book on the list is sent to you, and so on. And we've been using this method for about 22 years, but, you know, things change, and recently there's been issues with the postal service and people not receiving books in a timely fashion. So we've decided to make a slight change, but we think it will benefit everyone who's still using the CD service. So from the 9th of January, when you receive a book, you'll no longer need to return it to us to receive your next book. We'll look at your frequency of how often you get a book at the moment, and we'll send out books automatically. So if you get at the moment, say, 2 books a week, you'll continue to get 2 books a week. If it's 6 books a week, you'll get 6 books a week. If you think I'm getting too many or not enough, you can contact the RNIB helpline and they'll be able to change the frequency as to how often you get a book on CD. The CDs that you get from RNIB will continue to come in the same type of packaging. The CD has your address on it. And normally, of course, you would have to take it back to the post office and send it off, and then you get your next book. And some people found that difficult. So we are saying to customers now that you can, once you receive your book, you can keep that CD for as long as you want. You can recycle it. You will be able to send it back to RNIB and we'll recycle it on your behalf, but that, as I say, won't affect how often you receive CDs. The only thing we see you mustn't do with it due to copyright issues is, you know, pass it on to someone else. But in all other respects, you know, the service is exactly the same. We're adding lots of books every month to the collection. We've got around about 38,000 books at the moment available.
So quite a lot of information to take in there, Paul. I think the most important thing to emphasise initially is that the CD service is not going away. For those readers who prefer to receive books on CD, that will continue to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're committed to still making books physically available on media. You know, it's interesting because I think those are the two who grew up with cassettes, you know, and then CDs came along. And now, you know, because of digital and music on demand, you know, CDs aren't as popular as they used to be, but certainly for talking books, they're not going away anytime soon. It might be that eventually, you know, everyone is downloading books digitally or listening to them on their smart speaker. But until that happens, we're very committed to making CDs available. It is a slight change where we're, you know, asking people not to necessarily return the CDs. But we think it will make a difference because people will get books on a more sort of regular basis, and not having, you know, you don't have to return them to then get your next book sent to you. So we think it's a change for the better. And as I say, you will be able to change the frequency of how often you get a book if you find you're not getting enough or you're getting too many. So, you know, the amount of books that you read in a week and a month is still in your hands. And you know, with a quick call, you'll be able to change that the frequency as to how often you get a book.
Right, so if you were going away on holiday, for example, and you didn't want those CDs piling up behind the door while you're away, then obviously let the helpline know and we can pause the service.
Absolutely, yep. So, you know, as I say, the amount of books you read is still in your hands. And once you've got the CDs, you can keep them or you can recycle them. In case customers aren't aware, you know, when you send a CD back to us now, we send it off for recycling in any case. So if you recycle it yourself, or, you know, you can still send it back in the packaging and it will be recycled.
So can you put CDs in your regular recycling then, or does that vary a bit depending on where you live?
I think it will probably vary. You probably can, but I would check with your local council just to make sure.
Okay, so short version is you no longer need to return audiobooks sent out on CD from RNIB's library. Check with your council to make sure that you are able to recycle that in the appropriate way. You're asked not to share the CD with anyone else. So that's actually different from the Braille service, Paul, isn't it? Because with the Braille, we have said that you can pass the Braille on to another reader if you want to.
That's right. With the Braille on demand, where, you know, Braille is printed out and sent to you in a number of volumes, you can pass that on, recycle and so on. But with the audio books, a lot of our books are produced by publishers themselves rather than being recorded by RNIB. So they obviously have a vested interest in making sure that only people who are eligible can listen to the books.
Well, thanks very much for the update. We appreciate all the hard work everyone does in the Talking Book service. We know it's one of the crown jewels of RNIB, a much-loved service, those Talking Books valued by readers up and down the country. Thank you so much for all you do. And obviously, if readers really are at the end of their tethers with waiting for the postal service, then it may be worth trying out some of those digital download options, and of course reading services, and our Technology for Life team can help with all of that. Paul Porter, Digital Transformation Manager from RNIB's Reading Services, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Pleasure as always.
Thanks there to our friends at Tech Talk. Some important changes to the RNIB Talking Books Library. And talking of the library, why not use it to get fit?
2023 is upon us, and with many of us choosing to focus on our health in the new year, you might be looking for some motivation. Well, today we're going to take a look at two health and fitness titles released last year and available through the RNIB library. Now, first up, we have a British adventurer, writer, television personality, and former soldier and marine, Ant Middleton, with his book 15 Rules to Strengthen Your Body and Mind.
Every sports day, I'd be there smashing records. Nobody could outjump or outrun me. But I felt enormous pressure every time to perform. My confidence in myself was bound up in my ability to win these events. There was so much expectation on my shoulders. I thought that if I lost, then nobody would respect or value me anymore.
The mind and body are often talked about as separate entities, but it's only when they work in harmony with one another that one can truly push oneself to the highest heights. In his new book, Ant Middleton lays out and explains the principles that he lives by to best keep his mindset and body as strong as they can possibly be.
And then one sports day, a new kid at school, who'd arrived as a totally unknown quantity, beat me in the 100 metres. I've been so used to obliterating everybody year after year that the loss really shook me. It made me realise how fragile my confidence actually was, and it knocked my faith in lots of other areas of my life. I told myself that because I wasn't any good at running anymore, I'd probably struggle at everything else too. That mood lingered for a long time afterwards. So the next time sports day came around, I was actually reluctant to even enter the sprint because I was afraid of the damage that another defeat would wreak on my confidence. Maybe this time round, I'll just stick to the field events, I thought. I could feel fear and anxiety tugging at the corners of my brain, telling me that I wasn't good enough. As it turned out, I did run that race, and this time round, I won. Afterwards, I thought about how close I'd come to giving in to fear. Had I listened to those negative voices in my head, a small amount of doubt and uncertainty would have taken up residence in my head. Over time, it would have grown like a virus, infecting the rest of my mentality. But by not surrendering to my fear and anxiety, I exposed my insecurity and overcame it. I can now see how much I had wrong back then. Your confidence should never rest on the approval of others.
15 Rules to Strengthen Your Body and Mind is read by Ant Middleton himself and lasts 7 hours and 27 minutes. Now let's have a look at a slightly different title from the health and fitness category. Released last year by Alex Light, You Are Not a Before Picture is an empowering guide to abandon diet culture and learn to make peace with our own bodies.
I've spent far too long seeing myself as a before picture. You know the one, the person with the slumped posture and the really sad demeanour in the infamous side-by-side shot, just waiting for their glow-up, read weight loss, that's guaranteed to make them suddenly happy, successful, admired and desired.
It is not your fault that we see our bodies as projects in need of constant work. This is just one of the beliefs that has been ingrained in us by diet culture. We have been taught to view ourselves as a collection of problems for which the billion-dollar diet industry holds the solutions. Step by step, You Are Not a Before Picture provides a framework for changing the way we view ourselves and the world around us. Working with experts in the fields of psychotherapy, fitness, and nutrition, Alex empowers readers to interrogate their underlying beliefs, challenge the external and internal forces that are holding us back, and finally find freedom in our bodies for good.
I ate a snack that read only 98 calories on the packet, front and centre. I scrolled TikTok before bed, saw one ad for intermittent fasting and one ad for gym leggings to get rid of cellulite. You get my point, it is everywhere. And it's no wonder it's so pervasive. As we've discovered, diet culture has been with us for a long time. It's rooted in history and ingrained in the fabric of our society. So it's not our fault that we are also entrenched in it. If you feel bad about your body, or if you have been a chronic dieter like me, that's not on you. But it's time for us to rebel. We might not be able to get rid of diet culture completely, but we can build up a personal armour against it so that when we encounter it, we're able to let it bounce off rather than internalise it and allow it to inform our beliefs about ourselves and our own bodies. We can't let it take any more of our power away from us. The first step to building that armour is understanding it and how it came about.
You Are Not a Before Picture is read by author Alex Light and lasts 6 hours and 29 minutes. Now, if you fancy checking out one or both of these titles, you can do so through the RNIB library. Just visit readingservices.rnib.org.uk, sign up for your free account and search for Ant Middleton's 15 Rules to Strengthen Your Body and Mind or Alex Light's You Are Not a Before Picture. Plus, you'll be able to access RNIB's growing collection of over 30,000 books to borrow, download, and listen to on your smartphone, tablet, computer, or other reading device. Now that is it for our Best in Health and Fitness from 2022. Make sure to listen to RNIB Connect Radio as we highlight a couple more titles in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Paulina. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Still to come, Claire Keegan and Candia McWilliam.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online, or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine in 35 years I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. From Russia with Love, a James Bond adventure by Ian Fleming.
Yubiyanomat! The gross obscenity was a favourite with General G. His hands slapped down on the desk. Comrade, there certainly is a man called Bond, as you put it. His voice was sarcastic. Shem's Bond. And nobody, myself included, could think of this spy's name. We are indeed forgetful. No wonder the intelligence apparat is under criticism. General Vozdvizhensky felt he should defend himself and his department. There are countless enemies of the Soviet Union, Comrade General, he protested. If I want their names, I send to the Central Index for them. Certainly I know the name of this Bond. He has been a great trouble to us at different times, but today my mind is full of other names, names of people who are causing us trouble today, this week. I am interested in football, but I cannot remember the name of every foreigner who has scored the goal against the Dynamos. You are pleased to joke, comrade, said General G, to underline this out-of-place comment. This is a serious matter. I, for one, admit my fault in not remembering the name of this notorious agent. Comrade Colonel Nikitin will no doubt refresh our memories further, but I recall that this Bond has at least twice frustrated the operation of Smersh. That is, he added, before I assumed control of the department. As I say, I've been doing this for 35 years now, and I just hope it carries on forever. Even when my teeth have fallen out and I'm totally gaga, even then I'll have to be dragged kicking and screaming from the studios. I've loved doing it, particularly because we've had some wonderful responses. We all get them. One woman got in touch once, and she was quite late to talking books, but even then a whole new world had opened up for her. And it was just so exciting to hear that, and makes it all worthwhile.
Roberts asked if he could finally add a line to end this, written by him, but I'm going to say it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
And now on Read On, it's time to have a listen back through the RNIB Talking Books archive.
Today, we're chatting to Candia McWilliam, who narrated the introduction to her book, What to Look For in Winter, A Memoir in Blindness. Candia McWilliam had just joined the judging panel of the Man Booker Prize for Fiction in 2006, when she started to lose her sight. The gradual onset of blindness seemed like an assault, especially tailored for someone whose life consisted of reading and writing. At first, she could only dictate, and the unfamiliar process unblocked a flow of memory and association concerning her childhood in Edinburgh, her mother's suicide, her teenage escape into another identity, finding and losing bearings in Cambridge and London, her marriages, her children, and stalking all of these, her increasing alcoholism.
A paper umbrella. One of the last things my mother gave me was a paper umbrella. It must have been from Japan. Its wooden spars were webbed with an oily paper that smelled of pine resin and fish. When you put the umbrella up, the paper separated from itself with a faint disgustingness of sound, unidentifiable as yet to a child of eight, that would later reveal itself to be that of flesh separating from flesh, or the frozen surface of a lake beginning to shiver apart. My paper umbrella was of little use in Edinburgh, a city with some call for the kind of umbrella that keeps off not the glare of the sun, but the fall of the rain. Nonetheless, I loved it. My mother was a woman with too many superstitions, a trait I have inherited, so she didn't like the umbrella to be put up inside the house. I didn't want to upset her, so I would stand just outside the house on the stone step under my orange paper umbrella, whirling it and looking up through its oily sections, listening to the seagulls mewing over our street. My mother shook silver in her pocket under the new moon, avoided looking at that moon through glass, said she wouldn't have hawthorn or peacock feathers in the house, and telephoned on our party line regularly to St. Anthony of Padua when she lost things. Or she tried to keep to these strictures. In fact, she seldom had silver in her pocket. The moon went where it wanted to go, and she found herself surprisingly often arranging the hawthorn in vases or making fancy dress outfits for me, with glittering many-eyed peacock feathers she had stolen from the zoo. St. Anthony I cannot speak for. So she knew what to avoid, but did not quite do it. Hers was a compressed life, folded back down into itself only shortly after it had apparently emerged into some kind of light. Nonetheless, in its shade, other lives have grown up, my own and those of my three children. I have the instinct, too, that she had many friends, though I do not know this, and that people who met her remembered having done so, but that might be wishful thinking of the sort we scatter on the young dead. Tomorrow, this book of mine, which is greatly hers, goes to the printer. It is an account of many kinds of light denied. It is also the account of how certain forms of shade are rich, if you are fortunate enough to stay sufficiently long to read them. I have already lived for 18 years longer than my mother did. Wanting to surprise her when I was about 5, I tried to make purple ice cubes using violet ink. We had only recently become a family with a refrigerator. Before that, we had a meat safe, a sort of individualized Iron Maiden. I took the burning cold ice tray with its square eye baths for the water, held in tight form by a metal grid, like the letters in my printing set. Each one I filled with the dense, swarming ink and water mixture, black until you spilled it, when it flowered kingly purple. I was acutely conscious that I must be quick as I dosed the small moulds, no shuggling. It occasioned the sort of rapt guilt that making sentences can, to a child taught only of the primacy of fact. I was lucky not to be born such a child, though later events were to change that. The private nature of what I was doing was blissful, as was the idea that my actions were exactly aimed to delight someone I loved. I closed the ice compartment upon my inky tray of socketed dark water. I returned to my drawing at the kitchen table and waited for my mother. The tact required from her must have been great. Purple hands covered her small new fridge. She went about her kitchen tasks until such time as it would have been natural to open it, perhaps to get some milk or some anchovy paste, of which, and smoked cod roe, she was fond. I often wonder whether she and I are really part-time seals. Inside, the shelves and contents of her newly acquired zone of hygiene and modernity were drenched imperially with violet ink. She took in what I had intended rather than what I had achieved. She told me that it might be fun, next time, to use food colouring, not ink, so that no one would be poisoned. And we could put in some grapes, too, or flowers. So, a short life, but one in which she took time to pay close attention to the ideas of others. She had little, but was much. This book is the merely paper umbrella that I have been able slowly to erect against the usual human weathers and one surprising cloud, my blindness, over several years. Sometimes, as I have variously spoken it or tapped it out, I have felt as though an umbrella of skin held between bones were forcing itself through my person. Why umbrella? Again, I have returned to that paper umbrella. Shade is the most one can ask. Shade from which to see with some kind of truth, neither hectic with sunlight nor sodden to blackness. The world of addiction and recovery from it is full of necessarily approximate language. Plenty of aesthetically snooty addicts hang offshore from sobriety, unwilling to accept the slogans on offer. I know several. I have been one. It's too easy, though, to go clever against the pat sayings that offer you some handhold as you fall. I came. I came to. I came to see. Let go and let God. You have to open up to the possibility that your private pain is not to be held furled and weapon-like, but to be opened out as you fall, parachute, not ferrule, so that it may protect another, a collective shelter from a fearful rain.
Candia McWilliam reading a part of her introduction to What to Look For in Winter, a memoir in blindness. The rest of the book is narrated by Sherry Baines. It's also available in Braille, and the print version is available in any good bookshop. After the recording of that, I spoke to Candia, and she told me about the book.
I didn't ever think that I'd write an autobiography, because one of the things about being a writer of fiction is that do you want to keep yourself out of it? And then I had this peculiar experience, which was in 2006, when I was a judge on the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. I started to lose my sight, and I was so baffled by this, and so was every doctor whom I went to see, that I started wanting to capture the experience. And then I must confess that I thought I wanted to hold on to the last shreds and inklings of sight that I had left. And I wrote the first half of the book by dictating rather than by writing down, because I was what's called functionally blind, which meant that my eyes were fine, but my brain had closed them and it simply would not open them. And the second half of the book I wrote by holding my eyes open with my hands. So I typed very badly. I tapped slowly, a letter at a time, and my eyes grew very raw. And that's how the book was written. And I was, throughout that whole period, stone blind. My eyes just would not open. And then I have regained a measure of sight through surgical intervention, which the book describes, I hope not too disgustingly, but it's almost too macabre to go into here. Though I hope it's a story about how not seeing is in a sense a way of seeing, and of seeing differently, and as always with a story that's about words and about being human, it's how can we grow to understand one another. So it was an adventure inside my own head that was like becoming someone quite other than me, in a sense of privilege, in a sense of loss. And it isn't over, the adventure, and that is because, in spite of very frequently feeling like death, I didn't embrace it. And so I'm here to tell, I hope, the tale, and I hope further tales, which isn't me plugging any potential novels, it's just me hoping to connect with you, who I hope are listening.
No, we can't ignore the physical difficulties there were while writing the book, but emotionally, was it the hardest thing you've written?
That's a very difficult question to answer, and it's impossible to know, because art is to a degree emotion recollected in tranquility, and when you're doing the recalling, it feels as intense as anything else you have felt. So I'm not sure I could compare. In one way it was much harder, which is I had to overcome my natural inhibition and flinching from about talking about myself, because the thing about an autobiography is you can't leave yourself completely out of it, though I must admit I have tried.
Now, you've both won awards and been on the judging panel of the Booker Prize. Tell us about the process and how important are awards for writers?
I think they're happy accidents. I don't think that there's anything very rational about them at all. Very frequently, the winner of an award is chosen by compromise or horse trading. I don't think I'm telling you anything new when I tell you that. And they're very seldom completely unanimous. And it's lovely winning prizes, but I don't think you think any better of yourself. You just feel gratitude towards the accident of fate that's come your way. And so I'm pleased to have won prizes. And when I was a child, I used to enter competitions relentlessly just because I thought, well, why not? Very frequently, the sort of competition that one could never possibly win because I have almost no skills. I do remember writing a letter to the Bunty, which was a comic, and I wrote a letter, and I think I was about six, saying my dog can lay the table. As you can imagine, that was, of course, a lie. And I was very sad when it wasn't published. And I badly wanted that prize, which was a pair of ballet shoes, because I was too fat to do ballet, but I thought I could sort of hold on to them and dream. And that's a prize that really would have mattered had I won it. So NB, anyone who's used to work for the Bunty in the 1960s, feel bad.
Thanks once again to Candia McWilliam. What to Look For in Winter, A Memoir in Blindness is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. The introduction is narrated by Candia herself. The rest of the book is narrated by Sherry Baines. Head to www.rnib.org.uk/library. And of course, the print version is available wherever books are sold. A Case of Knives, A Little Stranger and Moving On are also available from RNIB.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB Helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Last year, when I interviewed all of the authors on the Booker shortlist, I asked them all for the books of their life. But in the end, we only played the winner's selection. So now I'm taking the time to go back through that audio and give you book recommendations from some of the top authors writing in English. Claire Keegan was on the shortlist for her book Small Things Like These. Here's a short edited version of her interview. The full one's available on our podcast feed. Just search for Read On RNIB in your favourite podcast app for our full Booker coverage. But here's Claire, and in a moment we'll hear the books of her life.
RNIB has worked with the Booker Prize Foundation for over a decade to ensure that some of the best novels are made available to blind and partially sighted people. Book titles are not always automatically produced in alternative reading formats such as audio or braille, which means that people with sight loss often have to wait much longer to get hold of the latest and most popular books. With funding from the Booker Prize Foundation, we make sure the shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are produced in all formats as close to the shortlist announcement as is possible. On that shortlist is Claire Keegan with Small Things Like These. At 116 pages, or in audio terms just under 2 hours, it's the shortest book ever to be nominated for the Booker Prize. Set in small town Ireland in 1985, it's the story of a hard-working man and a choice that could alter his life forever. The audio version is read by Aidan Kelly.
Furlong had come from nothing. Less than nothing, some might say. His mother, at the age of 16, had fallen pregnant while working as a domestic for Mrs. Wilson, the Protestant widow who lived in the big house a few miles outside of town. When his mother's trouble became known, and her people made it clear that they'd have no more to do with her, Mrs. Wilson, instead of giving his mother her walking papers, told her she should stay on and keep her work. On the morning Furlong was born, it was Mrs. Wilson who had his mother taken into hospital and had them brought home. It was the 1st of April 1946, and some said the boy would turn out to be a fool.
Small Things Like These is the story of a man named Bill Furlong who lives with his wife and 5 daughters in a small Irish town in New Ross called New Ross in County Wexford in the southeast of Ireland. And he has a coal business. He has a coal and timber yard and hires a couple of men there to and delivers coal and sticks and briquettes and cylinders of gas to the people of the town. One of the places he delivers coal to is a Magdalen laundry, a convent up on the far side of the River Barrow. And it's the story of what he encounters there and I suppose what he does with what he believes in. And it's a story of fatherhood.
Bill was previously oblivious to the goings-on in the convent. I'm trying not to give any spoilers away, but was that obliviousness the same for most of the population, or like Bill's wife, for instance, are they a bit complicit?
I think people don't want to know. It's not that people know and know a great deal and do nothing. I think a lot of people just want to try and mind what they have, because it's so easy to lose everything when you have just enough or not even enough. I think it is so difficult, so easy for people to lose everything, and very difficult, I think, to be brave. And I suppose I wanted to criticize Catholic Ireland to some extent for how difficult it was to be a good Christian in the Catholic Republic we created.
Yeah, because we should say the Magdalen laundries were real and investigations are still ongoing.
Indeed. Indeed they were.
Do you think Bill had a sense of survivor guilt then?
I think he may have had. I think he was also loved. That's the peculiar part of his character to some extent, even though, of course, it's not at all peculiar, but he wasn't brutalised the way others were. And he was an only child. And he did have more than enough, and he was loved when he was young, and he was minded and cared for, and he was also taught, I think, not to hate. I don't know that he was able to refuse that to a child, because he himself could have been that child.
Now, one thing we don't get if we're downloading the audio version is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us?
The cover is taken from a Peter Bruegel painting. And it's a crow flying over a winter scene, and it's just a detail. And there's a number of people, quite a few people on the cover. But yeah, that's what we wound up choosing, as there were many things going on in the painting, and I felt that suited the community I was trying to portray in the book.
The main of Furlong's infancy was spent in a Moses basket in Mrs. Wilson's kitchen, and he was then harnessed into the big pram beside the dresser, just out of reach of the long blue jugs. His earliest memories were of serving plates, a black range, hot, hot, and a shining floor of square tiles made of two colours, on which he crawled and later walked, and later still learned resembled a draughts board, whose pieces either jumped over others or were taken. As he grew, Mrs. Wilson, who had no children of her own, took him under her wing, gave him little jobs, and helped him along with his reading. She had a small library and didn't seem to care much for what judgments others passed, but carried temperately along with her own life, living off the pension she received on account of her husband having been killed in the war, and what income that came from her small herd of well-minded Herefords and Cheviot ewes. Ned, the farmhand, lived in too, and seldom was there much friction around the place or with the neighbours, as the land was well fenced and managed, and no money was owing. Neither was there much tension over religious beliefs, which, on both sides, were lukewarm. On Sundays, Mrs. Wilson simply changed her dress and shoes, pinned her good hat onto her head, and was driven as far as the church by Ned in the ford, which was then driven a little farther on, with mother and child, to the chapel. And when they returned home, both prayer books and the Bible were left lying on the hall stand until the following Sunday, or Holy Day.
Now, the audio version is read by Aidan Kelly. Have you heard his reading of it?
Yes, I have, and I thought it was very good, and I've recorded it myself also, so it's interesting.
And now, time for Books of Your Life from author Claire Keane. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, I really didn't have many books when I was a child. My mother used to, as a special, really as a special present, buy me a Ladybird book every now and then. There was a little wire stand which rotated in the veterinary and chemist shop up in Carnew. And every now and then she'd let me buy a Ladybird book, and that was just wonderful. So I grew up thinking there were very few books in the world. We didn't have many books at home. And so I think that was a good thing now, looking back. People might see that as a shortage or a shortfall somehow. But I went out and appreciated the books I did get and read them and reread them. And then I also had lots of time to imagine things, where my head actually wasn't stuck in a book. And maybe that was a good thing for a writer. But I did have Peter Rabbit, which I think wasn't mine. It might have been one of the hand-me-downs, but I thought it was a wonderful book. And I loved the danger in it. And one of my favourite sentences still is that moment when he's in Mr. McGregor's garden, and he runs into the shed and he jumps into the watering can. And I think this, it's a long time since I actually looked at this now, but I think it says, it would have been a beautiful thing to hide in had it not had so much water in it. And of course he sneezes then and Mr. McGregor finds him. But I think that's one of the most memorable from childhood. I think the other one's probably Little Red Riding Hood, because I grew up in the middle of a wood. We had a farm in the middle of the wood. So that always used to frighten me, that I would think I would meet something coming out of the trees, especially at dark.
Peter was most dreadfully frightened. He rushed all over the garden, for he had forgotten the way back to the gate. He lost one of his shoes among the cabbages and the other shoe amongst the potatoes. After losing them, he ran on four legs and went faster, so that I think he might have got away altogether if he had not unfortunately run into a gooseberry net and got caught by the large buttons on his jacket. It was a blue jacket with brass buttons, quite new. Peter gave himself up for lost and shed big tears. But his sobs were overheard by some friendly sparrows, who flew to him in great excitement and implored him to exert himself. Mr. McGregor came up with a sieve, which he intended to pop upon the top of Peter, but Peter wriggled out just in time, leaving his jacket behind him, and rushed into the tool shed and jumped into a can. It would have been a beautiful thing to hide in, if it had not had so much water in it. Mr. McGregor was quite sure that Peter was somewhere in the tool shed, perhaps hidden underneath a flower pot. He began to turn them over carefully, looking under each. Presently, Peter sneezed. "Kerchoo!" Mr. McGregor was after him in no time, and tried to put his foot upon Peter, who jumped out of a window, upsetting three plants. The window was too small for Mr. McGregor, and he was tired of running after Peter. He went back to his work. Peter sat down to rest. He was out of breath and trembling with fright, and he had not the least idea which way to go. Also, he was very damp with sitting in that can. After a time, he began to wander about, going lippity-lippity, not very fast, and looking all round. He found a door in a wall, but it was locked, and there was no room for a fat little rabbit to squeeze underneath. An old mouse was running in and out over the stone doorstep, carrying peas and beans to her family in the wood. Peter asked her the way to the gate, but she had such a large pea in her mouth that she could not answer. She only shook her head at him. Peter began to cry. Then he tried to find his way straight across the garden, but he became more and more puzzled. Presently he came to a pond where Mr. McGregor filled his water cans. A white cat was staring at some goldfish. She sat very, very still, but now and then the tip of her tail twitched as if it were alive. Peter thought it best to go away without speaking to her. He had heard about cats from his cousin, little Benjamin Bunny. He went back towards the tool shed, but suddenly, quite close to him, he heard the noise of a hoe. Scratch, 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 scratch. Peter scuttered underneath the bushes. But presently, as nothing happened, he came out and climbed upon a wheelbarrow and peeped over. The first thing he saw was Mr. McGregor hoeing onions. His back was turned towards Peter, and beyond him was the gate. Peter got down very quietly off the wheelbarrow and started running as fast as he could go along a straight walk behind some blackcurrant bushes. Mr. McGregor caught sight of him at the corner, but Peter did not care. He slipped underneath the gate and was safe at last in the wood outside the garden.
That's Diana Bishop reading Peter Rabbit from Beatrix Potter, The Complete Tales, available from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
I don't know that there's one I go back to again and again, but if I had a rainy week now or a rainy day, I probably would be in the mood for Pat Barker's Regeneration. It's such a beautiful book, and Dr. Rivers is one of my favourite characters. I think sometimes we fall in love with a character in a book, and I fell in love with him. I thought he was so astute and listening and kind and articulate and observant. And when I left him in the book, I was kind of waiting to go back to him again. Not that I thought the other parts were weaker. But I did love that book. I do love that book. I think it's an astonishingly well-written novel.
Now, just before I play a clip from Pat Barker's Regeneration, I'll say that this is the fourth Booker interview I've done this year. They so far have been an author from LA, one from Sri Lanka, and one from Zimbabwe. And you're the first person that I haven't had to explain the concept of a rainy day to. None of them get rainy days.
Well, the Irish woman will know who he is. I think by your accent you probably know as well.
It's not far away. Raining right now, yes.
Sassoon leant out of the carriage window
still half expecting to see Graves come pounding along the platform, looking even more dishevelled than usual. But further down the train, doors had already begun to slam, and the platform remained empty. The whistle blew. Immediately, he saw lines of men with grey, muttering faces clambering up the ladders to face the guns. He blinked them away. The train began to move. Too late for Robert now. Prisoner arrives without escort, Sassoon thought, sliding open the carriage door. By arriving an hour early, he'd managed to get a window seat. He began picking his way across to it through the tangle of feet. An elderly vicar, two middle-aged men, both looking as if they'd done rather well out of the war, a young girl and an older woman, obviously travelling together. The train bumped over a point. Everybody rocked and swayed, and Sassoon, stumbling, almost fell into the vicar's lap. He mumbled an apology and sat down. Admiring glances, and not only from the women. Sassoon turned to look out of the window, hunching his shoulder against them all. After a while, he stopped pretending to look at the smoking chimneys of Liverpool's back streets and closed his eyes. He needed to sleep, but instead, Robert's face floated in front of him, white and twitching, as it had been last Sunday, almost a week ago now, in the lounge of the Exchange Hotel. For a moment, looking up to find that khaki-clad figure standing just inside the door, he thought he was hallucinating again. "Robert, what on earth are you doing here?" He jumped up and ran across the lounge. "Thank God you've come. I got myself past fit." "Robert, no. What else could I do? After getting this?" Graves dug into his tunic pocket and produced a crumpled piece of paper. "A covering letter would have been nice. I wrote." "No, you didn't, Sass. You just sent me this. Couldn't you at least have talked about it first?" "I thought I'd written." They sat down, facing each other across a small table. Cold northern light streamed in through the high windows, draining Graves's face of the little colour it had. "Sass, you've got to give this up." "Give it up? You don't think I've come this far, do you? Just to give in now? Look, you've made your protest. For what it's worth, I agree with every word of it. But you've had your say. There's no point making a martyr of yourself. The only way I can get publicity is to make them court-martial me."
That's Michael Tudor Barnes reading from Regeneration, Book 1 in the Regeneration Trilogy by Pat Barker. Available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
There is. I would like to recommend The Promise by Damon Galgut. It really is a wonderful novel. It's a South African novel, and it's about land and greed and covetousness and betrayal and families, and it's just so many of the things a good novel should be, and it's beautifully written. It won the Booker Prize last year, so it probably needs no heralding at all. Everybody probably knows about it at this stage, but it is the first book that comes to mind.
He looks down the hill to the other side, where he lives, in the crooked little house, the Lombard place. That's what everyone calls it, even though old Mrs. Lombard died years ago before Amor's grandfather bought it to stop that Indian family moving in and let Salome live there instead. Some names stick, some don't. Our house. It'll be yours now. He blinks, still confused. It's always been his house. He was born there. He sleeps there. What is the white girl talking about? Growing bored, he spits and stands up. She notices how long and strong his legs have become, the wiry hairs growing on his thighs. She can smell him, too, the stink of sweat. All this is new. Or maybe the noticing is new. And she's embarrassed already, even before she's aware he's looking at her. "What?" she says, huddling over, arms on her knees. "Nothing." He jumps over to her rock, crouches down next to her. His bare leg is close to hers. She can feel the warmth and prickle. She jerks her knee away. "Ugh," she says, "you need to wash." He gets up quickly and leaps back to the other rock. Now she feels sorry for chasing him away, but doesn't know what to say. He picks up his stick and hits with it again. "Orat," he says. "Okay." He walks back down the hill the same way he came up, slashing with the stick at the white tops of the grass, pushing it into termite hills, letting the world know he's there. She watches him till he disappears, feeling lighter now because the big black car has gone, and a big blackness that was sitting on her has gone too. Then she wanders down the other side of the kopje, pausing here and there to look at a rock or a leaf, to her own house, or the house she thinks of as her own. By the time she comes in through the back door, 133 minutes and 22 seconds have passed since she ran away. 4 cars, including the long dark one, have departed. A single new one has arrived. The telephone has rung 18 times, the doorbell 2. On one occasion, because somebody has sent flowers that improbably turn up all the way out here. 22 cups of tea, 6 mugs of coffee, 3 glasses of cool drink and 6 brandy and cokes have been consumed. Numbers go on and on. But what does mathematics help? In any human life, there is really only one of everything.
Damon Galgut's The Promise is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Peter Noble. And once again, Claire Keegan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be on the show.
Got time for on today's show, but remember this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.